This is Pastor Walter Gretchen introducing today's edition of Youth Finds the Way, continuing the series of programs from the Mass Communications class of Concordia Seminary taught by Mr. John Pitzer. Today, the program is presided over by Melvin Younger, who will introduce the subject for discussion and his guest.
Is there any value in a high school student being made to plow through Shakespeare's Macbeth? Why should a student who is contemplating a career in engineering attempt to digest a few novels each year, especially if he can wait a year or so and see it in a Hollywood spectacular? These questions and similar ones are going to be discussed by two English teachers who come with first-hand information. Would you two to introduce yourself and give us a little background about your past training and teaching position?
I'm Nancy Carbett, and I teach English at Lucan High South. I went to Valparaiso University and graduated there with a major in English.
And I'm Judith Engel. I teach English and journalism at Lucan High School Central in St. Louis. And I also graduated from Valparaiso University with a Bachelor of Arts in English.
Thank you. Perhaps the best way that we can get at our question this afternoon is to find out what are some of the literary works a high school student is exposed to in the area of novels, poetry, and plays. And then while you are listing a few of the different works, perhaps you could comment on the value of reading such literature.
In practically every English program and every course of study, in each year, the class as a group reads some special project, book, or play. For instance, in high school in St. Louis, in the freshman year, the students all read Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. In the sophomore year, they concentrate on Tales to Cities by Charles Dickens and Julius Caesar by William Shakespeare. This required reading program isn't quite so well organized in the upper levels in the junior and the senior year, although each year, the teacher usually sets up a program of required reading in the form of a book list in which the student has several books to choose from. Sometimes this is quite strict choice, so that each student will be reading the same book set sometime during the year. Other times the book list is quite lengthy, and the student is allowed a quite free choice from the book list. Some of these are classics, some of them are, you couldn't call them classics, I guess. More modern books that haven't had a chance to get to be classics. At any rate, the student has a selected list of literature that the teacher feels is worthwhile for him to look at least when he goes into the library to choose books for required reading, which usually consists of one book per 6 weeks. The book review is written. Is the similar program that you have at all?
Yes, we have very much the same thing, with each year having a certain emphasis, such as you mentioned with Treasure Island or Tale of Two Cities. In the upper divisions, the junior and senior year, many of the classes work with anthologies, which are already prepared and have already chosen for you what the editors think are the best poetry and the best plays to read. And again, this leaves a little bit of initiative for the teacher, too, to choose whichever poems or stories she thinks is best. Like, for instance, we've just finished reading Macbeth in our senior literature class, but if I had felt that it was perhaps more fitting for the class I had not to read it, I could have also have chosen not to read it, but I guess we'll be saying more about Shakespeare later.
Would you care to elaborate on the idea of reading such literature, what values there are in?
Yes, I was just going to bring that up because people are always wondering, well, why do I have to plow through Tale of Two Cities and so forth? And within recent years, this program has been subjected to some reevaluation. One of the motivating factors, I think, in choosing these particular books that we mentioned, the fact that they have been chosen. They're long-standing classical selections. In this, I think there is some value. As I told my students when we just started reading Julius Caesar last week, each person in our culture has has a background which he shares with every other person. This makes him feel as if he is sort of part of the group. You might say there's some feeling of give and take to people who have a similar background, and one part of this background might be the literary works that they have read. Even if they laugh about how horrible it was when they read Julius Caesar when they were sophomores, still it gives them a kind of rapport that they can establish with other people. Maybe this is too much standardization, though, I don't know. The reason that many of these works have been, the choice of these works has been subjected to reevaluation is that often we find the students, many of the students, aren't ready to read them. This is particularly true with something like Dickens, with just the vocabulary itself is far beyond what many of them have been exposed to. And then too, there's a little bit of illogical thinking in the anthologies with which we have to work. On the freshman and sophomore level, for instance, many of the selections in the book are very, very simple. They're almost so simple that the students themselves get bored. And then, out of the blue, they have presented me this complicated thing, this novel by Charles Dickens, and there isn't a lot to serve as sort of introduction, sort of an easy getting into some of this very difficult stuff. So sometimes I feel that the students won't be able to benefit from reading something very, very difficult like this. Within recent years, some publishing houses have come out with, well, if you want to disparage them, you can call them watered-down versions of some of these works, rewritten ones, so you take the same plot, the same characters, and so forth, but simplify the vocabulary and leave out some of the deeper parts of the story. For students who are less advanced in reading, this is good because they at least become acquainted with the story. And then they get this cultural background angle. Mm-hmm. For other students, it's a complete waste because they are bored with it. And so you have to be careful to select who reads what book. Some teachers have divided their classes since we have grouping in which there is no selection of homogeneous grouping. The students are all thrown together. You have some brilliant ones and some backward ones in the same class. Some teachers have taken their classes and divided them in half. And one half of the class will read one book and one half of the class will read another book. One might read Dickens and another one might read Jack London. And they will read them simultaneously, and so each half will profit from the discussion conducted by the other half, so they will be absorbing both at the same time, while the one won't be frustrated by reading too difficult a novel, and the other group won't be bored by reading one too simple. And so sometimes this is a good idea to adjust your program to suit the students.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to this idea of the classics, I suppose it depends on what level you work with as to what opinion you have about this. But working with seniors, and perhaps being a dyed in the world English teacher, I kind of feel that everybody ought to have his chance at the classics. And I know just as you approach something like Macbeth, you can perhaps feel the trepidation in the classroom because the students are a little bit leery of it, and perhaps it's not something that they would pick up on an evening of themselves and read. However, maybe it's just because I want to feel this way, but I do feel that when they are finished with it, they themselves realize that they were glad they were pushed into it. Maybe it's because Macbeth is a judicious choice and it's one that most people like, but in discussing this with my last year's class, we came to this conclusion that they were awfully glad that they had read it. They really didn't realize how Shakespeare was very human and really wasn't so hard to understand after all. I think sometimes it's treated so much as kind of a thing that you should stay hands off and don't push it on them so much so that they won't want to read it later on. And then I think there's always a distinction between not liking a book and not knowing a book. Many of the students don't like Shakespeare because they don't know it. And so I always say, well, at least you owe it to yourself as an educated person to try reading it. And then if you don't like it when you do, well, then that's all right. And I think most of them agree with this sentiment when they see that there's a big deal of difference between not liking a book and not knowing it. So that if they don't like it when they're through, well, that's their privilege. But at least they are see, we're working with a little different level, as Judy mentioned before, and you have all kinds of individual differences right in front of you. Then I think you have to reevaluate your standards a little bit, and maybe everybody isn't ready for classes. Although, this is what we're talking about here, a class project. On the outside, you require all kinds of book reviews. We set up the stipulation of a minimum of one every 6 weeks, but we highly encourage them to read more, and I'm sure this is done in other high schools throughout the country, so that they get a pretty good opportunity to read what they want on their own, too. And that maybe it isn't pushing them too much, to give them a little bit to chew off in class.
I found the same thing last year. You were talking about seniors. When we read A Tale of Two Cities last year with sophomores, I approached them candidly and asked them, when they'd finished reading the book, whether they thought Tale of Two Cities was a book to read as a class project for sophomores. So we chewed around on the subject for a while, and the consensus seemed to be that, yes, it's a good idea to take something very difficult, Mr. Wilde, so that you meet a challenge. Now, if it's so difficult that you are completely lost, then it's pointless, it's a waste of time. And in fact, it's detrimental to the reading habits of the students. But they themselves, even students who weren't superior, who weren't exceptional, said if it was a good idea to have something that's hard to work around on. Making them like the book, I think, or the selection of the play, I think a lot of this is involved with the presentation of it. It can be an exercise. If the teacher doesn't like it, the students won't like it to a large extent. They may learn to like it despite the teacher. But often, if the teacher is being enthusiastic about it, this will carry over, and the students will at least have a positive attitude toward it. But with these outside reading that you were talking about, I think you can really learn a great deal about what the students are interested in, which they're reviewing.
Yes, and this gets down to the whole idea of perhaps the question we should be worrying about here, what books do they read on their own? Why do they choose a book? What do they look for when they want to pick something up? Do you have any ideas on this?
Yes, I conducted a rather casual survey from some of my students, and I found that many of them read books that deal with subject areas they're interested in. Maybe they have a hobby, and so they read books or magazines to deal with this hobby in a very practical way. Maybe they like baseball, so they read baseball books. Maybe they science, so they read science fiction books. And it sounds as if they're getting too narrow a viewpoint, and I think perhaps that's true. But at least they have something to introduce them to books in general.
This problem of why they read books, I think, all boils down to the fact that kids they're people, and they like to read about the experiences of others. They like to experience. And therefore, you will find a lot of the young freshmen and sophomore girls reading typical First Orchid for Pat, or Sorority Girl. And you can almost look at them and pinpoint at just what stage in their development they are, what things they're worried about. Should I go study in high school? Should I not?
These are very deep problems.
Yes.
Their personal problems draws them to this literature?
In fact, there was a man in Chicago who did a study on this, Happus Hurst was his name, and he looked into the problem and came up with a theory that he called the theory of developmental reading. And he believed that most high schoolers, although particularly the lower division ones, would approach books according to their problems. And maybe that the teacher could even guide the students to certain books to solve certain problems. Not that it's a be-all and an end-all, but that at least it's a picture of how somebody else solved this problem. And if the problem is related to the problem that the individual student has, say a girl wants to know, well, should I go steady? So she reads a story about high school people going steady and problems that I run into in a situation like this. And he said that this was developmental, that they really developed their emotional stability sometimes by reading these books. And so he thought that very definitely that you could equate personal traits and personal standards with books that they received.
So they would have to be conscious of the type of counsel that was given in each book.
Yes.
And if they would be drawn to a magazine article that gave perhaps a colored or
the wrong type of emphasis, this would be bad, but if you can mind it.
This is one of the difficulties in teaching English, because, one thing that always bothers me is that my college training, the literature courses that I took in college, are so remote from anything that I might suggest to one of the students to read, since we don't study books like Wait for Marcy and Orchids for Pat. We read Milton and Pope and things like this, and it just doesn't apply, except that it's valuable to have this as background. But you yourself have to do a lot of the reading of these books. If you want to be conscientious to help the students, you have to read teenage books. And this is a recent development within the last 10 or 15 years, that well-written books are coming out on these subjects. And they're not classics, but they hit the students where they need it. And so this is very valuable.
Yes, and makes them ready for the classics, I think, then. This man even went so far as to say that the classics, for instance, Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment and some of the others, really maybe are just developmental values that are so to such a high degree of organization that you wouldn't think of it as being a typical high school problem, of the problem that the main character runs into in Crime and Punishment, but that in a way, this still depicts people and their problems, and you get a certain amount of this out of reading even a book like Crime and Punishment.
A lot of it depends upon the maturity of the outlook of the student. Adolescents, teenagers, are all wrapped up in themselves. This doesn't mean they're self-centered, but they themselves are the absorbing thing in their life, and they haven't learned to understand themselves well enough, so they haven't got the time to be concerned about philosophical problems or psychological problems or people around them. And these developmental reading books meet their need, and for this reason they are good. I wouldn't use them as a class project of reading, but for their outside reading they are very good.
It seems that you've been putting the best construction on anything here, and complimenting the years on what they have been reading. Is there anything on the negative side that you would like to bring out? Are there reading things that definitely are detrimental for them? And if they are, how can we steer them away from this type of literature?
Well, let's take the first half of the question. Are there even things that are detrimental to them? They certainly get exposed to a lot of things that are detrimental. Maybe not always reading, maybe things like television and movies and so forth. They can pick up a lot that we might label pornography just in the newsstand. And many students, I as a teacher, often don't find out about this. There's no way to find out about it. We have 150 students, how can you find out what each one is reading around the clock? And this is one important place where the parents come into a position of great influence. If the parents really show concern about what their student is thinking, or what their child is thinking, I should say, this will is really a great deal of influence. Someone commented that nowadays it seems that many parents are concerned for the physical welfare of their children. They put clothes on their backs, they put food in their stomachs, they give them a roof over their head. Maybe they are too busy or too wrapped up in themselves to be concerned about the mental or spiritual or psychological development, or at least to keep track of it. And a student can do a lot, or a child can do a lot, that his parents know nothing about. If the parent doesn't take the opportunity or the effort to find out. And this is one place, I think, where just keeping tabs on what your child is reading can show you a lot about what your child is thinking.
I think this is has to be more of a project than just the teacher. As you said, the parent is important, and even the community in general. I just recall Judy and I went into a drugstore, this was last week sometime, and just happened to look over their shelf of paperback offerings. And it was most interesting because here you had side by side some very good novels. They even had Shakespeare in paperback, and then right next to it some book that I'm sure wouldn't be worth its weight in anything. And a student who now has the opportunity of purchasing books at 35 cents a piece can pick up things much more readily than ever before. Although in this drugstore there was a little sign over the top of the counter that said something like, we only sell magazines and books which are approved by
Legion of Decency.
Something like that. Or although some of the ones they approve, they don't think would fall under the Legion of Decency. But this is at least a beginning, at least an attempt. There is a certain amount that I suppose the teacher can do as far as guiding the student's reading, although I suppose a lot of these things, as you said, we just don't know. No student's going to come to you and say, well, do you think this would be good to read, if he knows it's a little bit off color.
They know.
Something he, yes, they know. It's something that he would want to be doing on his own. Of course, yeah.
I think that much of the stuff that they read, stuff is perhaps a good word for it, doesn't harm them, but it doesn't develop them either, and so it's sort of a waste of time. And this can be counteracted if you make them interested enough in the things that will help them or develop them or give them something to think about. Give them, make them interested enough in these things to read that they don't have time to read the trashy stuff. One thing that we have been doing at our school is to capitalize on programs set up by the junior scholastic or senior scholastic organization. They make very appealing leaflets and set up an organization called the Campus Book Club, or the Teenage Book Club. And there's another one too, for the lower grades, I believe. I don't know, even what the name of it is. And each month the student has this leaflet put into his hands. It's very appealing, and with photographs and with synopses of books, makes it look very glamorous. And the books are selected for their wholesomeness and for their literary value and for their interest to the teenagers. The Campus Book Club is designed for 11th grade up, and the Teenage Book Club is designed for something like 7th through 10th grade. And here they find some books that they can buy. They're paperback books, and none of them cost more than 50 cents, 65 cents sometimes. They can buy them, they are theirs. And this matter of possession is also something which helps build their interest in reading. They can get them easily, and if they have them there to read, then they aren't prone to pick up some of the things that won't be doing them any good.
This is a program that every high school student will have an advantage of?
Well, if the teacher so chooses to adopt it.
It's up to the teacher, mm-hmm. Each
student has the opportunity to buy these books, although it's not a requirement. We present them with this little leaflet, and they're encouraged also to buy, because if they buy five books and the suggestion is one free. And it's kind of commercialized, mm-hmm. But that makes it very appealing to them, I think.
But this is a national, mm-hmm. scope. Yeah. Every high school could take advantage of it if it wanted to.
It's particularly good for rural areas where libraries are deficient.
Mm-hmm.
Here, even though the libraries are excellent in the county and in the city and in school, still it's a matter of physically forcing yourself to get to the library. And so if the book is brought to the student, maybe we're feeding them too much, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it encourages them to spark their interest, and then they themselves will have the initiative to go to a library later on.
Well, thank you very much for taking your time out to come down here and record this program for us. I'm sure that you have opened our eyes in many areas to the position of literature in the hands of youth. I know my opinion of it has been elevated and taking a new look at it right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Melvin Younger, for bringing Nancy Corbett and Judy Yingle to our microphone to discuss literature and young people. This is Pastor Walter Gropian inviting our radio audience to join us again for the next session of Youth Finds the Way, which will be heard after Christmas on the 7th of January. Join us then for Youth Finds the Way on Sunday, 12 to 1. This is Pastor Walter Grocery, and introducing today's edition of Youth Finds the Way. In this second program in the series prepared by the Mass Communications class from Concordia Seminary, taught by Mr. John Fitzer, our moderator is Tom Bunnett, who will introduce two students speaking on culture and youth activities in Western Europe and in America. Mr. Bunnett.
Young people are good observers, especially when in foreign lands. Today, as guests on Youth Finds the Way, we have an American who visited in Europe and a European who is now visiting in America.
Well, my name is Tekla Brockenhoff, and I came from North Germany, Bremen, and I'm studying here at Washington U, and I studied first the language of English, and then for a second language, French. I hope that I get that Washington U is a good school, and I think I'll learn a lot there.
I'm John Heinemeyer, student over at Concordia Seminary from Alamy, Texas. I'm in my fourth year at the seminary. Had 2 years of vicarage at Bowling Green University and Bradley University in Peoria.
Welcome, John and Tekla. I'd like to ask you, John, what some of your observations were about the young people in Europe when you were traveling over there. When was it that you were in Europe?
A classmate of mine and I were in Western Europe in the summer of 59. We just decided to go over to more or less find out what our roots were and to observe the people and the culture of Western Europe. I suppose anyone that goes over to a foreign land expects to see certain things there and certain attitudes, customs, and I could say this afternoon that we found many of the things that we were looking for, but we found many things that we didn't expect as well. In our observations of the young people over there particularly, we expected possibly to see more depth, more culture, a different way of doing things from the young people here in America. And this we didn't find in too great a degree. Young people are the same, by and large, anywhere that you have them. I suppose one of the greatest ways we had of observing young people was in our travels. We found this, especially in Germany, that the young people do a lot of traveling in the summertime, in their vacation periods. People in high school and people, say, 20, 21 years old, take off for a week or 2 weeks and go to any part of Europe on bicycles, hiking, staying in the youth hostels, which are built specifically for them. And we were able to observe many things about the young people in this way, in staying in the youth hostels just as they were. The young people in Germany don't have too many cars. They, I would say, live a little more of a simple life. They do wear blue jeans. The girls wear ponytails.
You're right.
They do like the jitterbug. The time we were there, they were all singing Tom Dooley. So actually, it's not too much, by and large, they're not too much different.
Yeah, like you say now, it's this, in this way, it's not much different. Like, they have their time, their off time, their, like you call
vacation
that,
vacation
right?
Period.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
No, I don't mean vacation period. I mean, after they finish working, what they do, that's the same then that's over here. But like you said already, it's like on bicycles, they travel and they go with hitchhiking, say the right word.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, when you're in America, that's what I found out, you're lost without a car because the distance is so far and it's the towns are long and you can't do nothing without a car. In Germany, you walk or take a bicycle or so, and it gives a lot of difference to the way, what you're doing in your time off, your vacation and everything.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in high school, we went to all different places and with bicycles and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
do you feel that the young people in Europe, for their recreation and for their entertainment,
recreation?
Yes.